I. Kennan's containment doctrine stood Lenin's thesis on its head. It was the Soviet Union, not the capitalist countries, that needed to expand to survive. Without expansion to justify totalitarian controls, a huge secret police, and massive expenditures on the military, the USSR and its leaders would have to explain to the people why they had virtually no cars, little good food, and a staggering lack of basic items, such as soap and toilet paper. Containing the Soviets and stifling their expansionist ventures would focus Russian attention on their sad domestic economy, which was accelerating the collapse of communism through its own dead weight. Containment would make the communists, not the capitalists, their own grave diggers. The second edge of the sword, then, became a military alliance with the free countries of Europe. Several European countries, England, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, had signed a collective defense pact in 1948. Now Truman sought to join and expand and strengthen it. Norway and Italy were invited to join, along with Canada. On April 4, 1949, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, was established, linking America directly to European entanglements for the first time since the Revolution. Under the agreement, an armed attack against one would be considered an attack upon all. Since the United States already had established the fact that any attack on American assets was an act of war, to which the response could be atomic bombing, the NATO treaty effectively linked the Western European powers to the U.S. atomic umbrella. To more firmly cement this relationship, Truman ordered 4 U.S. divisions to Europe for permanent duty there, with the Allies' consent, in essence putting American bodies in the line of fire to ensure full participation by the United States. Leftist scholars have sought to paint the Soviets as victims and NATO as the villain. One mainstream text argues that there was no evidence of any Russian plan to invade Western Europe, and in the face of the American atomic bomb, none was likely. This is simply fantasy, as recent documents from the former Soviet states have revealed. The Warsaw Pact had a plan in place for an invasion of the West that included a barrage of tactical nuclear weapons just ahead of the Soviet advance. More important, the Soviets' espionage network informed them fully that American atomic bombs could not be delivered in sufficient numbers against targets in the USSR, and certainly could not be dropped on Western European soil without a massive backlash that probably would split the alliance. Pro-Soviet historians ignore the incredible buildup of offensive forces by the USSR, giving the lie to the notion that the massive Soviet arms expansion was defensive. Almost immediately, Stalin, in June 1948, probed into the Allied belly at Berlin. The former German capital, fully surrounded by communist East Germany, remained an isolated outpost of liberty in an ocean of totalitarian control. West Germany had limited access to the western sectors of Berlin, while the Soviets controlled the other half of the city, making Berlin an outpost in enemy territory. If such a metropolitan region became prosperous, as was the tendency of capitalist areas, it would pose a startling, shining contrast to whatever Marx's ghost offered. Stalin escalated control over cargo and rail traffic into West Berlin in April 1948, at which time an airlift had already begun bringing in small amounts of supplies. Stalin's move came at a key point in the election cycle, just as Truman was engaged in a tough re-election fight not only against the Republican, New York Governor Thomas E. Dewey, but also against 2 renegades from his own party, Dixiecrat Strom Thurmond, who headed a states' rights wing of the Democratic Party, and Henry Wallace, who appealed to the party's disaffected radicals as the Progressive Party candidate. Wallace ran a phenomenally expensive campaign, spending $3 million as a third-party candidate, easily the most costly and least productive per dollar presidential run ever attempted, generating only 2.4% of the vote. As usual, everyone underestimated Truman, who threw himself into a whistle-stop campaign as only an American president could do. At one campaign stop, a supporter yelled, "Give 'em hell, Harry!" Truman shot back, "I only tell the truth, and they think it's hell." The electorate appreciated his candid approach, even if the media discounted him. When Newsweek magazine ran a survey of 50 journalists, all of whom predicted Truman would lose, the president countered, "I know every one of those 50 fellows, and not one of them has enough sense to pound sand into a rat hole." The epitome of media goofs occurred when the Chicago Tribune prematurely ran a banner headline reading, "Dewey defeats Truman." It wouldn't be the last time the mainstream media was embarrassed on election night. Once again, the country had rallied around an incumbent in a crisis. Stalin had to deal with a tenacious Truman rather than a conciliatory Dewey. Truman refused to give up Berlin, but had to do so without touching off World War III. He found a middle ground that forced the Soviets into the position of having to fire the first shot. Truman deployed 3 squadrons of B-29 bombers to Europe, hoping that Stalin would think they were equipped with atomic bombs. They were not. Rejecting General Lucius Clay's proposal to resupply Berlin by truck, Truman opted for a massive airlift. From December 1948 to the spring of 1949, American C-47s, C-52s, and escorts shuttled in up to 7,000 tons of supplies a day, demonstrating the Allies' resolve and impressing upon the Soviets the size and quality of U.S. air superiority. The Soviet dictator realized he could not order any planes shot down, that would be an act of war, and accepted, temporarily, that he was beaten, removing Soviet barricades and roadblocks to Berlin from the West in May 1949. Most advisors realized they had to rapidly rebuild the armed forces to counter the 2.5 million-man Soviet army. The Cold War would be a long one, one not decided by a few early skirmishes like Berlin. In fact, Stalin had made a critical error by greedily attempting to seize Berlin. Had he waited, the United States might have disarmed so thoroughly that rearming would have been politically impossible. His divisions might have simply walked into Berlin. But Eisenhower saw the danger and stepped in to support the president by conducting a swing through NATO capitals. He then returned to Washington to argue for decisive commitments to NATO. Eisenhower's speeches convinced Americans and Europeans that resisting the Soviets required them to act together. So Truman, occasionally in spite of himself, managed to win early victories on the political and military fronts. But there was yet one more battlefield for the Cold War, that of culture. America faced a serious propaganda hurdle when the communists could point to segregation of blacks within parts of the American South and claim that the democratic ideals held out to other regions of the globe were empty words. A series of programs sponsored by the U.S. State Department that sent American jazz musicians overseas proved important in that regard. American jazz was already extremely popular in Europe, with a ready-built audience for jazzmen like Dizzy Gillespie, Benny Goodman, and Louis Armstrong, who made tours of Europe, the Middle East, and Latin America. Jazz opened doors no diplomats could. As Eisenhower's vice president, Richard Nixon had encountered crowds in Latin America that spit on him and threw rocks at his car. But Louis Armstrong drew crowds that greeted him with standing ovations. Jazz bands carried understated but obvious messages without the need for speeches. First, many of the bands were integrated. Black, white, Jewish, and Hispanic musicians played alongside each other. Second, the very nature of jazz, and later rock and roll, epitomized democracy. The whole band played together in the opening verses and choruses, then a soloist would depart from the band to do his own thing while the rest of the group held the song together. Ultimately, the soloist would return to the scripted parts, reflecting the notion that in a democracy, people can cooperate, yet were committed to infinite individuality. Louis Satchmo Armstrong symbolized as a band leader that African Americans could attain leadership positions in American culture. Armstrong knew America had its faults. He had criticized the American government during the 1950s school desegregation crisis and the civil rights era, yet he was also a proud American. He gained such fame that he became known as the U.S. Ambassador of Jazz. In 1965, his band toured Eastern Europe, taking American jazz behind the Iron Curtain. 20 years later, when Ronald Reagan brought down the Soviet Empire, another American music form, rock and roll, played no small role in undermining communism's grip on the minds of the young. Containment and Korea. When Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin met at Yalta, they agreed to maintain spheres of influence in Asia, with the Russians taking the northeastern part of Asia, including North Korea, and the Americans dominating the southern part of China and South Korea below the 38th parallel. Mao Zedong, the communist Chinese leader in the north, had the advantage of a unified command of a large patriotic army and virtual sovereignty in Manchuria after the Soviets pulled out, taking all the machinery and hardware they could carry with them. His opponent, Chiang Kai-shek, leader of the nationalist camp, had some American support, but he suffered from internal dissension among his officers, terrible economic conditions inherited from the Japanese, and corruption. Chiang had squandered vast piles of American assistance, which totaled $2 billion from 1945 to 1949, although much of it simply vanished through the skyrocketing inflation inside China. Other factors, much more insidious, also helped undercut Chiang, including the State Department's pro-Mao tilt that consistently painted Chiang in the worst possible light and depicted Mao as a peasant freedom fighter. This policy was ably enhanced by Lachlan Curry, a Soviet agent working in the Roosevelt White House as head of the economic mission to China during World War II, who continued consulting on China affairs after the war. The result was that aid earmarked for Chiang, especially gold that could have stabilized the inflation, was delayed at critical times. All of this would surface later, yet the question of how U.S. policy toward China was bent toward Mao's forces was buried. In July 1947, General Albert Wedemeyer, former chief of staff to Lord Mountbatten, the supreme Allied commander for Southeast Asia in World War II, was ordered by Truman to report his findings from the time he spent in China. Wedemeyer cited, among other things, the need for U.S. training of Chiang's troops. Truman ignored the report. In 1949, Mao's troops crossed the Yangtze, capturing the capital city, Nanking, after which all but the most loyal of Chiang's army disintegrated and was pushed entirely off the mainland to the island of Taiwan, Formosa. There, the refractory Chiang established the true Chinese government in exile and vowed to return to the mainland. Amid all this communist expansion, where was the United States? Secretary of State Dean Acheson produced a white paper explaining that the United States had no hope of affecting the outcome of the Chinese Civil War and that getting American troops into a land war in China would be a disaster. Republicans, still isolationist at the core, nevertheless reveled in seeing the Democratic administration stumble so badly. Congress blamed the loss of China on policy errors and incompetent diplomacy. In truth, Acheson was right. Despite having utterly demolished the Japanese just 4 years earlier, the United States had played almost no role in actual mainland fighting. That had been conducted by the Chinese of both groups and the British, Australians, New Zealanders, and Indians. The forces that had existed in the Far East at the end of World War II had, for the most part, been decommissioned or reassigned. Any serious attempt to intervene would have required a full-scale buildup equivalent to that of 1942, combined with unrelenting use of atomic bombs, and then only if Russia stood by. No sooner had the world readjusted its maps to the new People's Republic of China than Acheson gave an unfortunate speech to the National Press Club. There he implied that Korea was no longer considered within the U.S. containment fence, thus suggesting to Kim Il-sung of North Korea that the southern part of the Korean peninsula might be obtained at a minimal price. Using the justification that the nationalist leader of the South, Syngman Rhee, would try to unify the two Koreas, Kim launched a general attack on June 25, 1950, quickly pummeling the Republic of Korea, ROK, forces. Truman had not backed down in Berlin and would not now hand over Korea to the communists. "We've got to stop the sons of bitches no matter what," he told Acheson, whereas the military and politicians alike shied away from a land war in China. Korea was different. Its small size and abundant coastline played to America's greatest advantages: mobile amphibious attacks, carrier-based air power, and easy defense of choke points. Truman also appreciated the fact that, unlike the Berlin crisis 4 years earlier, the United States now had an ample stockpile of atomic weapons and long-range delivery aircraft. Here, Stalin sought to play the Chinese against the Americans, warning Kim that the USSR wouldn't lift a finger if the North got kicked in the teeth by the United States. Instead, he admonished Kim, "Ask Mao for all the help." The Soviet dictator now joined the press and Truman's political opponents in underestimating Truman. Even so, Stalin was startled by the timing of Kim's invasion. The Soviets had been engaged in a walkout of the United Nations Security Council over another matter, meaning that for one of only a handful of times in its history, the Security Council voted with the United States on a major international issue. While the UN vote was desirable and put all forces in Korea under United Nations command, it could not conceal the obvious. The Americans would provide the bulk of the forces, as well as the supreme commander of the UN forces, General Douglas MacArthur. American forces arrived in the form of a weak task force after a slow response from Washington. The North Koreans easily overran Seoul and threatened to occupy the whole Korean peninsula. Reinforcements constructed a last-ditch perimeter defense around Busan, the nation's largest port, and finally repulsed the overextended North Koreans. Taking advantage of U.S. sea power, MacArthur staged a daring amphibious invasion at Incheon, behind North Korean lines, threatening to encircle and exterminate the entire North Korean army. His risky gambit is considered one of the most daring invasions in military history. The geography of the location alone presented almost insurmountable challenges. The tidal swell at Incheon was 37 feet, meaning that although high tide landings would be relatively easy, at low tide, ships would be stuck in mud. Initial troops would have to hold for 12 hours before reinforcements could again arrive. Wolmido Island, which controlled the harbor, had to be taken first, which would alert enemy forces to the attack when surprise was of the essence. American Marines took the island in 45 minutes, eliminated all the dug-in defenders, and did so without a single American death. MacArthur then defeated Korean troops that numbered 5,000 to 6,000 in the harbor and surrounding areas. In less than 2 weeks, Allied troops cut all the way across Korea, regaining the 38th parallel line, the original border whose violation had sparked the war. But MacArthur had proceeded farther north. For reasons of temperament and political ambition, MacArthur would have liked to have pursued the war beyond the 38th parallel anyway. But he had also received clear instructions from Secretary of Defense Marshall to feel unhampered tactically and strategically to proceed north of the 38th parallel, emphasis added. Both MacArthur and Acheson had assured Truman that the Chinese would not intervene, with the general predicting a slaughter if Chinese troops crossed the Yalu River. When the Chinese did launch a massive counterattack in November 1950, the UN struggled to hold the line at the 38th parallel. MacArthur, meanwhile, had grown increasingly critical of the president. He urged bringing the Taiwanese into the war, called for intensive bombing of Chinese bases, and a thorough blockade of the People's Republic. General Omar Bradley, among others, warned Truman that a full-scale war in China would be the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the president wisely refused to expand the conflict. Meanwhile, MacArthur's rank insubordination, as Truman called it, was not only undesirable, but dangerous, unconstitutional, and counter to the American tradition of keeping the military under control of civilians. In a bold and necessary stroke, Truman relieved MacArthur, sparking a public firestorm that even he misjudged. MacArthur returned like a Roman conqueror to address Congress to thunderous ovations as he bade farewell, saying, "Old soldiers never die. They just fade away." Relieving MacArthur had placed Truman in the crucible of public criticism, which naturally did not faze the president. What would Jesus Christ have preached if he had taken a poll in the land of Israel? He asked. "It isn't polls that count. It is right and wrong and leadership." Despite his frequent underestimation of the communist threat, the feisty Missourian protected the integrity of the presidency and squelched permanently any notion that military leaders could dictate public policy. Not since Washington had a general come so close to wielding as much power with public opinion as had MacArthur. It was a battle Truman had to engage in. The Korean conflict ended in a ceasefire in July 1953. No peace treaty was ever negotiated. And as late as the 1990s, the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas constantly threatened to erupt into widespread violence. The war had not been cheap. Some 33,000 Americans died in battle, in addition to more than 100,000 wounded and 15,000 missing or made prisoners. The Korean War, like Vietnam, featured dozens of bloody engagements and few memorable battles. Hills often had numbers, not names, and the most successful offensive of the war, devised by General Matthew Ridgway, was aptly named the Meat Grinder. The most oft-referenced geographic spot was not a battlefield such as Gettysburg, where a great victory had occurred, but the Yalu River, which American pursuit aircraft were not to cross. It was, according to one soldier, "the war we can't win, we can't lose, and we can't quit." In retrospect, though, it was neither a loss nor a tie, for the United States had achieved several critical goals as outlined in the Kennan Containment Document. First, the Sino-Soviet Communist Axis had failed to gain new territory, even after holding some three-fourths of South Korea with military forces. Second, both the North Koreans and the Chinese had been fought to a tactical draw on the mainland of Asia, employing a fraction of the troops that Japan had unsuccessfully fought China with less than a decade earlier. Finally, the enemy was brought to a peaceful, if tense, acceptance of a divided Korea without the use of nuclear weapons. America had shrewdly adapted the Western way of war to the new reality of atomic bombs. The war was the high watermark of Truman's administration, which was noteworthy for its foreign policy successes. But his presidency was far from perfect. Economic growth remained sporadic, and high inflation had left Truman with the nickname Horsemeat Harry, for the meats housewives had to substitute when beef prices rose too high. Labor battles had shut down several industries. All of this could have been treated easily, however, by application of basic free market economics, had Truman been so inclined. More problematic, Truman inherited a raft of Roosevelt appointees who were sympathetic to communists at best, or who engaged in treasonous activities and espionage at worst. Revelations about Soviet spies in America severely damaged Truman's otherwise well-earned reputation. Soviet espionage in 1950s America. Soviet spies in America had been active for more than two decades, of course, just as Americans themselves conducted intelligence operations in most major foreign countries. What the Soviets gained through their American agents, however, was substantial. One new study concludes that, contrary to the claims of liberals for many years, physicist Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, helped write American Communist Party literature at the University of California and may have been a party member. Another recent study of Soviet agents in America, based on newly released KGB documents and co-authored by a former Soviet agent, revealed that Russian intelligence agencies received substantial and sometimes critical information, including many classified documents concerning U.S. government policies on highly sensitive subjects, its confidential negotiating strategies, and secret weapons development, including essential processes involved in building the atomic bomb. The agents' skills ranged from those of practiced professionals to bumbling amateurs, but significantly, their level of penetration into the U.S. government is no longer in doubt. Ironically, by the time Senator Joseph McCarthy, Republican of Wisconsin, got around to discovering the presence of this underground network, it had been shut down for several years because of the defection of a single mentally depressed female agent. McCarthy, whose name has sloppily been linked to hysteria and totalitarianism, was a complex man. The last major American political figure raised in a log cabin, the Irish Democrat had switched parties after the Second World War, winning a judgeship, then the Senate seat that had belonged to Robert La Follette. He came into the Senate with his two friends, John Kennedy and Richard Nixon. Joe Kennedy liked McCarthy, and Robert F. Kennedy worked as the senator's staffer during his investigations. Like Joe Kennedy, McCarthy was blue-collar, rough, and viewed as an outsider. Given to both over-drinking and overwork, McCarthy had a strong record on civil rights and support of Wisconsin's farmers, but he tended to operate within the committee on which he was seated, the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, PSI. The PSI resembled the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, or HUAC, which had commenced operation in 1938 to deal with both Nazi and communist subversion. McCarthy failed to appreciate or capitalize on his own evidence that indicated America's national security had been penetrated at the highest levels under Roosevelt. The Agricultural Adjustment Administration had provided a breeding ground for young communist agents, sympathizers, and radicals in the 1930s. Harold Ware, for example, had already set up a network in Washington with 7 cells, all linked to the USSR. Owen Lattimore, editor of Pacific Affairs and a White House liaison to the State Department who drew a paycheck from the Office of War Information, was described by the McCarran Committee as a willing instrument of Soviet policy. Though opposed by his Senate committee, McCarthy, soon assisted on his own staff by young Robert F. Kennedy and on the House side by Congressman Richard Nixon, pursuing Alger Hiss, succeeded in grabbing headlines and sounding a warning. Too often, McCarthy's willingness to tout any unverified piece of information or to act before he had proof obscured the fact that the genuine damage already had been done to American security and that most of the people he identified as communists were. Indeed, every security or loyalty risk McCarthy brought forward in his February 20, 1950 speech either had resigned or been dismissed from government. Among those he exposed were Gustavo Duran, Mary Jane Keeney, Edward Pozniak, John Carter Vincent, T.A. Bisson, Cedric Belfridge, Leonard Mins, and William Remington, who was killed with a bar of soap in prison by a patriotic inmate. In alleging that the U.S. Army itself had security breaches, however, McCarthy challenged the integrity of General George Marshall, at which point Americans' patience ran out. Many of his supporters turned against him. The Senate censured him in 1954, and his health deteriorated until his death 3 years later after long bouts with alcoholism. McCarthyism subsequently became a term synonymous with repression and terror, an amazing development considering that not one of the people subpoenaed by the senator to testify lacked legal counsel. None were arrested or detained without due process, and no one went to jail without a trial. All through the worst of the McCarthy period, the Communist Party itself was never outlawed, membership in the party was never declared a crime, and it continued to maintain public offices, publish works, and the Daily Worker, wrote McCarthy biographer Arthur Herman. If anything, McCarthy's investigations underestimated the number of active Soviet agents in the country. At one time or another, the KGB regularly debriefed not only Harry Dexter White and Lawrence Duggan, but also Michael Strait in the State Department, an agent known as Morris, thought to be John Abt in the Justice Department, Boris Moros, a Hollywood producer, and well-known columnist Walter Lippmann. Some, such as Duggan and White, deliberately and frequently shaped their internal policy memos to best benefit the USSR, not the United States, according to recently released KGB material from the Soviet archives. Even though the Eisenhower administration quietly abandoned the search for communists in the government, the assault on American communists became broader and, one could say, more democratic, as communists found themselves harassed, prosecuted, and hunted by the government with the enthusiastic support of large segments of the public. Unions led by Walter Reuther of the United Auto Workers and Philip Murray of the CIO had kicked known communists out even before McCarthy started his famous hearings. J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, often stood alone in the administration. He turned anti-communism at the Bureau into a nearly personal vendetta. From its 1944 peak of 80,000 members, the American Communist Party had shrunk to below 20,000 in 1956 and fewer than 3,000 in 1971. Hoover had considerable help, however. State and local officials often ignored or violated the constitutional rights of Communist Party members, and more extreme groups encouraged vigilante activity against known communists. Harvard University stated in May 1953 that membership in the Communist Party is beyond the scope of academic freedom and constituted grave misconduct justifying dismissal. That said, the fundamental fact was that overall the constitutional protections and the fair play and ethics of the majority of citizens restrained and limited anti-communist zeal. Without doubt, the public was hostile to communism and suspicious of fellow travelers, non-party members who abetted communism. In its last burst of pro-America activism, Hollywood chipped in with movies such as I Married a Communist and The Red Menace, produced between 1947 and 1949. The blacklisting of the Hollywood Ten is well known. Hearings in the movie industry saw one resolute witness, a young Ronald Reagan, defend the industry and question the attacks on civil liberties. Public schools promoted pro-democracy programs, and tell-all books by former communists abounded. The bottom line, however, was that anti-communism was a more serious response to genuine threats on many levels than it was a form of paranoia. And overall, the dislocations attributed to anti-communist movements were and are exaggerated. As historians of the American communist movement noted, even during the early 1950s, the high tide of McCarthyism, the Communist Party functioned legally. Its spokesmen publicly advocated its doctrines, its recruiters brought in new members, and its press published daily and weekly newspapers, journals, pamphlets, and books in the millions of copies. University purges were rare. Of the 1,850 colleges and universities with nearly 300,000 faculty in the 1950s, there were 126 cases of professors at 58 institutions dismissed or threatened with dismissal for their communist affiliation. The bad news was that the spy scandals here and in Britain indicated that communist infiltration into national security and the State Department was worse than imagined. Spies Julius Rosenberg, Klaus Fuchs, and others had given the Soviets the data they needed to make an atomic bomb. The spy revelations, along with the invasion of South Korea by communist North Korea and the fall of China to dictator Mao Zedong in 1949, led to sharp concern over Soviet espionage activities in the United States. Labeling this the Red Scare or hysteria is a gross exaggeration. Hysteria is an ungrounded fear, as opposed to concern based on genuine threats. As newly released Soviet documents confirm, without question, the USSR had penetrated virtually every important division of the U.S. government related to military, diplomatic, and security issues. Certainly, the opposition to the Cold War and agitation by so-called peace movements in America was manipulated by the Soviets. Ironically, evidence for this Soviet involvement in domestic peace organizations comes from a historian sympathetic to the left, Robbie Lieberman, who admits that American communists saw peace as bound up with the fortunes of the Soviet Union. As he noted, communist agitation for peace was bound up with defending the interests of the Soviet Union, especially guaranteeing its power, nuclear and otherwise, vis-a-vis the United States. The nation was quite rational in exhibiting serious concerns about such developments and, at the same time, was fortunate to have a war hero and level-headed Kansan as its new president, a man who could stand up to the excesses of McCarthy without in any way backing down from the commitment to containment abroad. What is less clear is how seriously Eisenhower took the threat of communist infiltration into the Roosevelt and Truman administrations. He appeared more embarrassed by McCarthy than concerned with the likes of Owen Lattimore and Alger Hiss. Some of Eisenhower's approach must be in part attributed to strategy, not wishing to expend his administration's energy pounding on the errors of his predecessor. Some of it must be chalked up to a certain, and in this case wrong, American presumption that large numbers of fellow citizens would not be traitors. Whatever the reason, Ike's unwillingness to be even slightly associated with McCarthy's cause led the new president to miss a golden opportunity to clean house of Soviet agents and, in the process, reinvigorate the conservative movement without the taint of extremism associated with the John Birch Society, a far-right anti-communist group, or McCarthy. The Eisenhower Smile. It was natural that Americans considered military service a training ground for the presidency. Most presidents had served in the armed forces, many as successful generals, and both Eisenhower and MacArthur entertained thoughts of a political career. For Dwight Eisenhower, one potential roadblock was that he had not been particularly political in his life, nor did the public even know what party he favored, although he had voted Republican those times that he did vote. Ike encouraged the impression among the media elites that he was somehow detached from the partisan wrangling of the day. Supporters lobbied him to run for office the minute he came home from Europe, but he demurred. He even indicated that he would have been happy supporting the party favorite Robert Taft of Ohio, 1889 to 1953, if Mr. Republican had endorsed NATO. Yet in a meeting with Eisenhower, Taft rejected American involvement in collective security for Europe, sealing Ike's decision to run. Like Truman, Ike did not mind being underestimated. Elites rallied to the Democratic candidate Adlai E. Stevenson of Illinois, 1900 to 65, but Eisenhower appealed to the common man. Seeking to blunt attacks from the McCarthy wing of the GOP, Ike named Congressman Richard Nixon of California as his running mate. In the campaign, Democrats charged Nixon with financial irregularities and corruption. The resilient Nixon, in one of the most famous political television addresses ever, carefully reviewed his finances, noting that he and his family had few luxuries, that his wife Pat did not have fur coats, but a good Republican cloth coat. They had accepted one gift, a cocker spaniel named Checkers, and with a tear in his eye, Nixon stated he would not give up the family dog. Unswayed, Ike certainly stood ready to dump Nixon if popular support didn't materialize, but the speech grabbed the nation's heartstrings, and he stayed on the ticket. Eisenhower buried Stevenson in the popular vote, garnering nearly 10% more votes and overwhelming him in the Electoral College, 457-73. Liberal journalists and academics have attempted to portray the election as one in which the lesser man won, that smart people voted for Stevenson but were swamped by the rubes. In fact, Stevenson was an avid non-reader, and the only book at his nightstand when he died was The Social Register. Voter statistics revealed that the more education someone had, the more likely the person was to vote for Eisenhower. Oddly, Ike irked the press by smiling a lot. But he also worked hard and long, and despite his demeanor, in some ways he lived hard, too. No soldier could achieve what Ike had without some rough edges. During the war, he drank 20 cups of coffee a day, smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day, and lived with myriad constant health problems. Ike played politics with the best, often opting for the indirect route that kept his friends and foes alike baffled, And, like Ronald Reagan after him, he delegated duties effectively. Unlike his successors, Kennedy and Nixon, Eisenhower had no love for the power or status of the office itself. Being president provided the means to improve the nation and, more broadly, the world. Advisor George Kennan found that in small meetings, especially on foreign affairs, Ike was a man of keen political intelligence and penetration who spoke of matters seriously. Insights of a high order flashed out time after time. When he wished to avoid a direct answer, Eisenhower employed military jargon to obfuscate and even pretended not to understand his own translator to deflect foreign queries. Most of all, Ike's animated face fit the times, like Lincoln's solemn demeanor fit his own. The Eisenhower smile was a political statement. America was good. Unlike Hitler or Stalin, America was offering the world a good man. Understandably, it drove fanatics and the alienated up the wall. He responded with straightforward and simple answers. Question: can you bring taxes down? Answer: yes. We will work to cut billions and bring your taxes down. A low inflation rate, just over 1%, and virtual full employment, 3% unemployment, contributed to Eisenhower's popularity. He balanced his budget 3 of 8 times, and the other years had only minor deficits. Long before Ronald Reagan established the 11th commandment, "Thou shalt not speak ill of another Republican," Ike had absorbed that principle. If he needed to bash a particular GOP opponent, he did so through references to general characteristics, not by name. When it came to Democrats, however, Ike could be brutal. And when it came to foreign enemies, Eisenhower took another tack, speaking in paradoxes and inscrutable philosophizing. The fair deal becomes dynamic conservatism. A central lingering domestic question that both Truman and Eisenhower had to deal with involved the continuation of the New Deal, or rolling it back, as some hoped. Welfare state liberalism had become entrenched by 1946, and despite his triumph over Wallace, Truman did little to slow the extension of federal programs. Truman raised the minimum wage, made an additional 10 million people eligible for new Social Security benefits, embarked on federal slum clearance, and proposed a large farm income program. Truman's domestic program, dubbed the Fair Deal in honor of his progressive forebears, also included 810,000 federally subsidized housing units. At almost every point, Truman allied with the big government forces. In 1953, therefore, Eisenhower had a remarkable opportunity. As the first GOP president since Hoover, he was in a position to limit or end some of the New Deal policies, especially with the House and Senate under Republican control for a brief time. Nevertheless, Ike recognized that part of his appeal rested on his bipartisan image. He had not run as anti-Roosevelt and was indeed far too progressive for some in the Republican Party, including Mr. Republican, Senator Taft of Ohio. Many voters thought Taft and other conservatives overemphasized anti-communism to the exclusion of other issues, although Taft is perhaps best known for his sponsorship of the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947, prohibiting closed-shop, union-only workplaces. Taft's insurgency failed, and the senator died in 1953, removing the most significant Republican opposing voice to Ike's policies, although remaining GOP insurgents forced the president to moderate the rate of growth of New Deal programs. Where Ike did reverse New Deal policies was in his cabinet selections, who were mostly businessmen. Among the group was the devout Mormon Ezra Taft Benson, who cut back federal ownership of hydroelectric power businesses and limited regulation of offshore oil leases. But Eisenhower did not hesitate to spend. The National Highway Act of 1956 used federal money to link the nation's cities, thus lowering private transportation costs. Blasted as corporate socialism for Detroit, the act reflected Ike's military experiences, in which he shepherded a convoy across poor American roads earlier in the century. His domestic strategy, called dynamic conservatism, was a policy that shed the criticism that conservatives were only against something and offered nothing positive. The minimum wage rose to $1 an hour under Eisenhower, and federal aid to education increased through the National Defense Education Act. Social Security benefits likewise rose, and Ike created a new super agency, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, to continue to administer the New Deal welfare state programs. Eisenhower did not end the New Deal, but he slowed its growth. The Atomic Genie. Both Truman and Eisenhower maintained a consistency in dealing with atomic energy and atomic weapons, realizing that atomic power provided not only new terrors, but also new sources of relatively clean energy for civilian use. Congress authorized the Atomic Energy Commission under civilian control to examine peaceful uses of nuclear power. Bernard Baruch, head of the War Industries Board in World War I, became the American delegate to the newly formed United Nations Atomic Energy Commission. To control the spread of nuclear weapons, which could easily grow out of the unchecked expansion of peaceful nuclear power, the UN proposed an international agency to supervise all atomic development. Baruch even submitted a plan to have the United States hand over atomic secrets to the UN on the condition that the United States, the USSR, and other nations likely to develop nuclear power would agree to allow international inspections at atomic installations. The United States, under those conditions, would agree to destroy its nuclear stockpile. The Soviets had already secretly started construction of their own atomic bombs, and they had no intention of allowing free access by international inspectors to anything. H-bomb testing produced fallout of a different sort when a national meeting of church leaders, scientists, authors, and other notables in June 1957 led to the formation of the National Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy. SANE. Emphasizing the human community, SANE placed ads in major papers protesting the H-bomb tests, but soon its agenda included international control over all U.S. weapons. By 1948, even before the USSR had detonated its own atomic bomb, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Truman's security advisors understood that temporarily the only way to protect Europe from further Soviet expansion was the threat, sometimes subtle, sometimes not, of the use of nuclear weapons by the United States in the event of aggression against any of the NATO allies. In a document called NSC 30, the first formal expression of American atomic policy, the United States deliberately left its options open regarding the use of nuclear weapons. After NSC 30, which effectively established the principle of linkage, America's enemies knew that the atomic weapons in the arsenals of democracy would not just sit by while Europe or Asia was being overrun. At about the same time, an independent group of civilians established the Research and Development Corporation, RAND, as a think tank to study problems associated with nuclear warfare. RAND employees, John D. Williams, mathematician John von Neumann, and others, concluded that nuclear war was not unthinkable, Quite the contrary, to prevent it, someone should think about it. Rand developed studies that crystallized the armed forces' concepts of how to use and how to prevent the use of nuclear weapons, essentially forming the theoretical basis for mutual assured destruction, or MAD. Eisenhower, along with Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, further delineated America's strategy in 1954 by making it clear the United States would, if necessary, use nuclear weapons even on non-nuclear countries that threatened American national interests. To the Soviets, who by then had their own nuclear arsenal, this sent a clear message that the United States would not be bullied. Wishing to keep the nuclear genie in his bottle, however, Eisenhower introduced a flexible response that allowed for a wide range of military options when confronted with local or regional threats. In short, Ike kept America's enemies guessing and off balance, never sure if aggression might invoke a nuclear response. This tended to keep rogue nations cautious and, for the most part, peaceful. Secretly, Eisenhower prepared the nation to win a nuclear war far more than historians have previously thought, going so far as to disperse nuclear weapons to the soil of allies such as Canada, then later to Greenland, Iceland, Greece, Italy, and Japan, beginning in the 1950s. America kept ahead of the Soviets and far ahead of the Chinese, as seen in the 1958 confrontation with China over the islands of Kimoi and Matsu in the Formosa Straits. The nationalist government claimed these islands, as did the communist mainland, which made plans to invade them. Quiet diplomacy provided an agreement, but looming over the discussion was the fact that the United States had an ace in the hole, as historian Timothy Boddy called the nuclear weapons. Time and again, this nuclear backstop enabled the United States to pursue its national interests in ways that few large states in previous eras ever could have imagined. In short, the implicit threat of its large nuclear arsenal permitted the United States to engage in less than total war and to pursue localized or limited wars on several occasions. Eisenhower also sought to develop a broader nuclear policy that would make use of atomic energy for peaceful purposes. In December 1953, Ike delivered his Atoms for Peace speech at the United Nations in New York City in hopes of breaking the deadlock over establishing international supervision of fissionable materials and of approving an amendment to the Atomic Energy Act of 1946 that provided for research in nuclear energy in civilian areas under the direction of the National Security Council. Thus, the federal government assumed authority of the safety and regulation of all civilian nuclear plants in the nation. This expanded federal power on the one hand, but it opened up an untapped resource to be used with confidence on the other. Sputnik, Cold War in Space. To America's shock, in August 1957, the Cold War took a new turn, or more appropriately, an upward arc, when the USSR announced it had successfully tested an intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, a rocket fired upward out of the Earth's atmosphere on an arc that would descend on a target and release warheads. Although the public did not immediately appreciate the import of these tests, in October, the Soviet Union claimed the lead in the space race by launching Sputnik 1 into orbit, using a launcher similar to that on their ICBMs. To the man on the street, Sputnik represented little more than a Soviet scientific feat. But added to the ICBM test, Sputnik's successful orbit suggested that now the USSR had the capability of raining atomic bombs on American soil safely from within bases inside Russia. Realistically, the Soviets had merely skipped a step in the development of nuclear weapons, temporarily foregoing construction of a long-range bomber fleet. Eisenhower personally seemed unconcerned. Not so the general public. Popular media publications, such as Life magazine, headlined its post-Sputnik issue with "The Case for Being Panicky." The public did not know that General Curtis LeMay of the Strategic Air Command, in an internal study reviewing the results of a simulated missile attack on American bomber bases, had concluded that the Soviet Union could have wiped out 60 of the major U.S. bases with a coordinated attack. Sputnik persuaded the United States to keep a force of long-range reconnaissance aircraft, the U-2 spy planes, in the skies over the USSR at all times to detect enemy preparations for an attack. Eisenhower also offered intermediate-range ballistic missiles to NATO allies such as Britain, Turkey, and Italy. Nevertheless, the public demanded a response to the threat of ICBMs. This came in a crash program aimed in two directions. First, money poured into education, particularly into universities and colleges for engineering, science, and math programs. Through the National Defense Education Act, 1958, Congress authorized grants for training in mathematics, science, and modern languages. That might have kept the money in the labs where Congress intended it, but by also funding student loans and fellowships, the federal government flooded the humanities and other university departments with cash, providing the financial base for the student rebellions that would dominate the late 1960s. Second, the United States moved with urgency to develop its own solid and liquid-fueled rockets, resulting in some early spectacular crashes as American technology exploded on launching pads or flew apart in flight. Defense spending surged, and Congress turned the National Advisory Council on Aeronautics, NACA, created in 1915 by President Woodrow Wilson, into a larger, more powerful agency, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA. In May 1961, Commander Alan B. Shepard, Jr. became the first American into space. Then, in February 1962, Colonel John Glenn was launched into orbit aboard a Mercury capsule. In both cases, the Soviets beat the United States to the punch, placing their own astronauts, a new term coined to describe space travelers, although the Russian cosmonauts preceded American astronauts, into space, then into orbit. To the public, these activities merely confirmed that the communists continued to lead in the space race. The images of exploding American rockets remained fresh, and even with Glenn's flight, American scientists feared the worst while they hoped and planned for the best. Military planners even had a plan, Operation Dirty Trick, that would blame Cuban communists if the Mercury flight failed. Soviet victories in space contributed to the cloud of anxiety that hung over what otherwise was a decade of prosperity and growth. Happy Days, Myth or Reality? A popular television sitcom called Happy Days appeared from 1974 to 1984 and depicted life in 1950s America as lighthearted and easy, with intact families, supportive communities, and teenagers who, although prone to an occasional prank or misstep, nevertheless behaved like upstanding citizens. Even the anti-hero, the Fonz, Vincent Fonzarelli, played by Henry Winkler, who sported a motorcycle jacket and a tough guy mystique, possessed a heart of gold and displayed loyalty, courage, and wisdom. Of course, in the cynical 1970s, critics salivated at the opportunity to lampoon Happy Days. They pointed out that the show did not deal at any length with racial prejudice. It did not, although Asian actor Pat Morita was the original owner of the diner. or family problems such as alcoholism and divorce. Again, guilty as charged. But the very fact that so many critics, especially of the left, responded so vehemently to Happy Days suggests that the show touched a raw nerve. Despite genuine social problems and hidden pathologies, despite racial discrimination and so-called traditional roles for women, and despite the threat of atomic warfare, for the vast majority of Americans, the 1950s were happy days. Without question, America's economy exploded thanks in large part to the golden accident of the post-war era in which former allies and enemies alike were still devastated and recovering. Briefly, America was the world's number one consumer and manufacturer and accounted for 45% of world production and 14% of world trade. American GNP in 1950 reached $284 billion, or nearly triple the nation's GNP a decade earlier. Was there anything special about this generation or the circumstances in which it lived? One view of the 1950s, focused on those who had entered adulthood in the decade or slightly before, comes from generational pundits William Strauss and Neil Howe. They labeled the group born from 1901 to 1924 the GI generation. By 1946, GIs would have reached 22 at the youngest and 45 at the oldest, putting them at the prime earning years of their lives. That coincided with the post-war economic boom that fitted together a generation viewed as fearless but not reckless, replete with heroes and full of problem solvers. As the inscription on the Iwo Jima shrine, itself a testament to their courage, puts it, "Uncommon valor was a common virtue." Adults of the 1950s included many of America's greatest achievers, including Walt Disney, Ronald Reagan, Lee Iacocca, Lyndon Johnson, George Bush, Bob Hope, John Wayne, Katharine Hepburn, Ann Landers, Billy Graham, Sidney Poitier, Walter Cronkite, Jimmy Stewart, Charles Lindbergh, and Joe DiMaggio. They produced such cultural monuments as Herman Woke's The Caine Mutiny, Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, Jackie Gleason's The Honeymooners, and Walt Disney's Lady and the Tramp and Cinderella. They initiated a spiritual revival that spread the gospel of Christianity more broadly through Billy Graham and the ministry of Oral Roberts. Epitomizing the spirit of the decade, the best-known comic strip character, Superman, fought for truth, justice, and the American way. 1950s Americans received the benefit of the largest one-generation jump in educational achievement in the nation's history. They had learned the importance of work, yet had worked less outside the home than any other group. And as a generation, they had an uncanny knack for backing the winning candidate in every single major election. They won 2/3 of all Nobel Prizes ever won by Americans, including all 14 prizes in economics. Supported in some of their affluence by grateful taxpayers, they received housing subsidies through mortgage interest deductions on taxes, and through the Veterans Administration, they received guaranteed mortgage loans to purchase houses. This group of adults also effectively changed the debate about racial segregation, with black intellectuals like Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, arguing that segregation not only was morally wrong, but also economically inefficient. By 1965, Look magazine would say, speaking mainly of the adults in society, "Americans today bear themselves like victory-addicted champions. They are accustomed to meeting and beating tests." This optimism hit a spiritual emptiness that characterized many of this generation. The efforts of preachers such as Billy Graham, Norman Vincent Peale, and Oral Roberts notwithstanding. Later surveys would show the 1950s generation to be in many ways one of the least religious groups in American history, and this may in part account for why their success, while genuine and admirable in many cases, was fleeting. Sooner or later, a sandy foundation of civic virtue, unsupported by deeper spiritual commitments, would crumble. What is amazing about all this is that the 1950s still had plenty of structure. Marriage and motherhood were considered the main destiny of young women, with teaching and nursing considered their only acceptable careers, and magazines such as Seventeen or Mademoiselle, or popular books such as Mary McGee Williams's On Becoming a Woman, all operated under this assumption. "It's not too soon to dream of marriage," ran a typical chapter title in Williams's book. Yet at the same time, roles were already changing everywhere. The entire concept of Ruth Handler's Barbie doll, introduced in 1959, revolutionized toys by allowing a much-needed play pattern that had never before been offered by the doll industry to little girls, namely role-playing outside of motherhood. Despite significant opposition, not the least of which was to the fact that the doll had breasts, 40 years later, The Economist would write, "Of all the forces against which resistance is futile, Barbie ranks near the top." Barbie only reflected the prominence of sexy female movie stars such as Marilyn Monroe, Jane Mansfield, Jane Russell, and Brigitte Bardot. Alfred Kinsey's Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, which appeared in 1953, indicated that women were having sex before marriage in large numbers, perhaps, if Kinsey's statistics were to be believed, up to half of the 6,000 women he had interviewed. Certainly men thought about sex all the time, or at least that was the premise behind the launch of Hugh Hefner's Playboy magazine in 1953, wherein photos of nude women were legitimized for viewing by middle-class men by packaging them with interviews, fiction, and serious reporting. The standard joke of the day was that a male, when caught in possession of a Playboy, would claim to read it just for the articles. As if to follow Hefner's lead, in 1957 the Cyril Pharmaceutical Company brought out the birth control pill, which proved instrumental in delinking sexual intercourse from childbearing, or, put another way, in separating consequences from actions. Before the pill, in the early 1950s, young adults, especially those married in the late 1940s, produced the largest boom in childbirths ever witnessed in the United States. Aptly labeled baby boomers, these children grew up in unprecedented affluence by the standards of the day. Adult expectations were that the boomers stood on the fringe of a golden era and would lay out blight-proof, smog-free cities, enrich the underdeveloped world, and, no doubt, write fini to poverty and war. New foods developed specifically for babies had experienced slow growth before the boomers began consuming boxcars full of